Friends, all of you, I think, practically speaking, are theosophists, or people who are very well acquainted with theosophical literature. It always seems to me that the basic idea that is involved in all theosophical thought is that man is rooted in the real. Now, of course, to define the real is almost impossible, but I think it means that which is independent of and survives any and all material states and transformations, that which lies entirely underneath, behind everything. I think the thing that we have to realize is that the real is not out there. It is not something separate from ourselves. It is something which lies at the heart, at the root of everything. And that this real is not subject to thought. It is not something which can be manipulated in any way by thought, because it always lies beyond the thinking process. But, and this is the important thing for every one of us, the real is immanent in experience. In other words, when we are totally involved in experiencing life, then we are aware of, we contact, I don't quite know what word to use, they're all wrong, but perhaps I can convey the idea. In that way, we touch the reality that lies behind everything. This, of course, was one of the great features that the Buddha spoke about some 2,500 years ago, that the only reality was the experience of the immediate moment, that at the moment of experience, we somehow added to all of our past, which, of course, is what makes up every moment of our lives, we added to our past that one new thing, which is the experience of the moment, which puts us in touch, as it were, with the only reality that we can know. Although I always dislike using the word know with regard to reality, because the word is so associated with mental processes. Now, intelligence unites with this experience, as it were, and unveils to us certain aspects of reality. This is what we are doing all the time. And by intelligence, I mean what we normally speak of as buddhi, if we want to use theosophical terms, that which is also called wisdom, that which is the root of that wholeness of thinking, that wholeness of intelligence, that pure reason, Annie Besant and Bhagavan Das call it in the Bhagavad Gita, which looks at things without any prejudice, without any bias, with real intelligence, trying to understand what is happening to us and in the world. Now, it is very important that we understand the way we look, because we see to a very large extent what we want to see. There's no one quite as blind as the one who doesn't want to see. And in all cases, we see very much what we want to see. If we like something, we see it in very glowing terms. If we dislike it, we see it in other terms. And always we look at things because we have concepts. We normally think in the reverse fashion. We say, we look at things, we analyze them, and therefore we produce concepts. But this is really not true at all. We have concepts, and therefore we look. A child gradually becomes aware, not by being told things, not by anything except by moving around, by being aware of the world round about him. He gradually grows conceptually to realize that he is a separate item, distinct, first of all, from his father and mother, and then from all the other creatures that he meets. And from this point of view, he gradually begins to understand, to know the world, to look at the world from a point of view of an eye, and begin to know it. Piaget, amongst others, has done, of course, a great deal to show how this takes place in the life of every individual. And it is very important that we realize this, that we have built into ourselves certain concepts, and we look at the world through those concepts. And all our ideas, all our views are modified by this. So that our views about the world and everything in it depends very largely on our concept of man and his relationship to the cosmos. It is that which makes the theosophist view different, shall we say, from the ordinary religious person, because he has a different idea, a different concept with regard to man and his relationship. And therefore he sees things modified by this view of his, which enables him to look at the world in a certain way. Now, as I said, we are rooted in the real, the absolute, that which, as Madame Blavatsky says, is essentially without relation to finite things. I know very few of us really like that particular phrase, but I think it's very important that we should realize it, because the absolute cannot be related to anything, or it would not be absolute. Absolute and relatedness are contradictory terms. But it lies behind everything, not related to everything. It is part and parcel of everything. It is pure beingness. But of course it manifests itself as being. And it is that of which we are aware. And in this whole process, universality, universal causality, unites us, connects man and the cosmos together. And this is really what karma is all about. That causality which connects man and the cosmos and makes the whole process of his life a causal process until such time as he begins to realize his oneness with all things. When he touches something which is outside of that causal process, that which lies behind the cosmos, that which is not concerned with its manifestations and its aspects. And the process that engenders and maintains the cosmos is really what we, following the Hindus, call Maya, illusion, that which is made. It is not that things are illusory, but their appearance within the fabric of reality is illusory. And it is that that we have to be constantly on guard against. It is because we regard this illusion as real that so many of the problems of our life arise. This is the pervading error, which is part and parcel of the human condition. It was said by some of the old Sufi mystics that to them the matrix of the world view remained immutable even while they were studying the world of becoming and change. And I feel this is what we must always do, is to realize this immutability and look at the world from that point of view. Now, all yogas are concerned with making whole. The word yoga, as probably all of you know, is associated with the English word yoke, that which binds together, yokes together. And therefore, it is the view of yoga that all fields, aspects, planes, bodies, whatever we like to call them, are all parts of one whole. And therefore, the changes in any one part affect the whole. This is the great truth that we must realize. if we think of man as a series of bodies, then we must recognize that a change in any one of them affects the whole. That man is primarily that being who unites within himself the highest spirit and the lowest matter. And I feel it is an error in the, what shall I say, the phraseology of our usual theosophical point of view, that we speak of man as a spirit using bodies as if these were somehow separate and distinct and not part of one continuing whole, and that it is the realization of that to which all yoga is directed. Of course, scientists are beginning to think in this way, as we saw, of course, at the symposium during this last weekend, and as Wheeler at Princeton has said, that we live in a participatory universe, that when man looks into the various parts of the atom, for example, the very setting up of his instruments in order to discover what he wants, position or velocity, somehow changes the whole universe, so that nothing happens within it but which affects the whole. And this, I think, of course, is equally and even perhaps more vitally true within ourselves. Now, of course, it is an error to think that books or lectures, even mine or anybody else's, can describe reality or to show us how to know, to get to understand reality. All that can be done is simply to affirm, to point out that it is there, and no one can show us the way. This is one of the difficulties. When we read books on yoga, when we read books of various kinds, we think that those books can show us how to find reality. I don't think that this is true at all. They can show us certain processes which someone has gone through. If we follow them, at best we get second-hand experience. But the way of yoga is to know for ourselves, and this involves first-hand experience, and therefore it is something that we must do ourselves. In The Voice of the Silence, you will remember that Madame Blavatsky says that we must become the path before we can tread the path. And this is really what yoga says, that we become the path, and in that way we begin to know it. And of course I feel that John Shear, writing in one of the magazines a couple of years ago, put it extremely well. He said, the future is not some place we are going, but one we are creating. The paths to it are not found, but created. And the activity of creating them changes both the maker and the destination. In other words, each one is making our own path and treading that path. And therefore, at every moment, we are both, as it were, making part of the path and determining the destination. It can perhaps put very clearly that we are all engaged in this as an individual process by another quotation I came across in one of the theosophical magazines, where it said, the metaphysical thinker is always on his own. Like the artist or the poet, he has to find his own way, and all the way by acts of self-reference, with only insight and reason to guide him. He can find no confirming reference in corporate truth. Only the test of life's experiences will tell him how close he may have come to the way things really are. But meanwhile, there is companionship in the resonance of other metaphysical thinkers. There is the reason that we hold meetings and groups and we get together. There is a resonance which is created by that, which somehow gives us the feeling of going on and discovering for ourselves, following our rather lonely path, but still the one which gives us the utmost satisfaction. Now to come back to something, of course, which I have spoken of quite often here, and that is yoga itself, the aphorisms of Patanjali, which are perhaps the clearest and best expression of the whole philosophy and method of Raja Yoga. There, in the very beginning, Patanjali defines yoga. And he says that yoga is the overcoming of the modifications of the thinking principle, the suppressing of the way in which the mind, the thinking principle, is constantly like a whirlpool and must be restrained in order that we can understand. In other words, we must restrain the eddies in consciousness. And then, after we have done that, then we abide in our own nature. That, I think, is by far the best definition of yoga that one can find anywhere in the literature. That when we restrain, suppress these eddies in our consciousness, which whirl about in our emotional and mental parts of our nature, then we can begin to abide in our own nature. That is, we can contact and know the real. For our own nature is part of reality. And that nature is not another I. It is not an I that we are finding. It is not a thing, an entity. It is not, as I so frequently have said, a captive balloon. You know, I really think most of us, when we think of our own true nature, tend to think of it just like all the cartoons that you find in the funnies. There, when somebody thinks something, you know, they tie it onto the individual in a little captive balloon. This is how I think most of us tend to think of the self, as somehow captive to us, tied to us by some sort of little string. And we hope that someday, perhaps, that we can pull that balloon down and get a little closer to it. But this, of course, is not the way to look at it. The I, if we can call it an I at all, is a completely impersonal I. It is really just part of one reality, not separate in any way. This is the great paradox of the whole thing. I always say that when you are talking of these things, if you don't talk in paradoxes, you don't know what you're talking about. And if you're talking in paradoxes, of course, I'm always doubtful whether anybody else understands what you're talking about. But this is part and parcel of the essence, I think, of trying to really comprehend what this reality is. Now, of course, normally in our lives, we are concerned with the eddies. We are concerned with these modifications of the thinking principle. And Patanjali, analyzing them as they so frequently and adequately do in the Indian literature, divides them into five states in which we find ourselves. There is, he says, first of all, right knowledge. Well, this means that we are looking at external things and understanding them rightly. And this is something, of course, which is very laudable, but it is still part and parcel of the thinking principle. It is not ourselves. Right knowledge is not something which is our own true nature, which lies entirely beyond knowledge. Or, of course, and I think far more frequently, we have wrong knowledge. or something which is partial somewhere in between. And these are the ways in which we look at the external world, and we have right or wrong knowledge about it. And then there are other three creatures of the mind, as it were, creations of the mind, which are also part of this modifications of the thinking principle, which Patanjali speaks of: fancy, sleep, and memory. Fancy is the way that we can create things in our mind which don't have any relation to anything which really exists in the physical world. The Indians nearly always speak of the horns of a hare, or we can speak of a unicorn, or some of those things which are part and parcel of the creative imagination or the fancy of individuals. Now, one thing, we must not think of any of these things as being wrong. They are part of the way in which we get to know the world and ultimately learn that they are looking at only an illusion, and that we have to get behind the illusion if we want to know ourselves. But they are always the way in which we react. And then there is sleep. Sleep is that is the absence of content from the mind. And this is, of course, a rather important thing. The phrase goes that sleep is that modification of the thinking principle which has nothing for its basis. And I admit, on my own rather infrequent times of sleeplessness, I have found thinking about that particular aphorism was a great soporific, and I didn't stay awake very long. But we must carefully distinguish this from meditation, which I intend to speak about later, because I think many people think of meditation as emptying the mind. But I'm afraid emptying the mind is really just sleeping. It is not really meditation. And then there is memory. This is one of the great problems for all of us. We tend to live either in the past or in the future. Live in our memories, or those memories of the past we project into the future. We think of what has happened, and we try to put into the future something which we can anticipate based upon that past, so that we lose the faculty for really experiencing life. We fall between, as it were, two stools, and we never really get down to experience. We think about life instead of experiencing life. And of course, all these five ways that he speaks of, right understanding, wrong understanding, fancy, sleep, and memory, all these are the ways in which we are conditioned. All these things condition us. And it is from that conditioning that we tend to look at life. And if we are to overcome these things, if we are to restrain these transformations which are constantly taking place in our consciousness, then we must really overcome our conditioning. This is one of the great paradoxes, once again, of life. In order to live, you must be conditioned. The whole of your life, from the moment you are conceived, you are conditioned by your parents, your surroundings, your teachers, the people you meet, the whole of the life in which you live. Yet, if you are to find yourself, you have, as it were, to get behind that conditioning, to be able to see things clearly, free from all the bias which that conditioning puts upon us. Now, how is this to be done? If this is the process of our life, how can we do it? Well, again, Patanjali says it is to be done by two things: exercise and dispassion. Now, exercise practice really means that we have to do it in living. It's not a process of trying to get away from the world, but a process of completely living in the world. You know, our knowledge does not generally change our behavior, but experience of life does tend to change our behavior. And this is what we're trying to do. It means that we must be constantly trying to look at the world and to look at life and to do things in the world, in our everyday actions, which are unbiased, unprejudiced, which are, in other words, completely impersonal and completely unprejudiced. Now, this can only be done when we realize the fact that we are conditioned. And this is often very difficult, especially for theosophists, I sometimes think, because we're all so sure that we are brotherly and impersonal and unprejudiced and things of this description. How can we possibly be conditioned? But if you look at yourself, of course it's really much easier if you look at somebody else, but it's really not quite as good for you. But if you look at yourself, you will soon become aware of the way in which you are prejudiced. You remember that Mr. Jinarajadasa said long time ago that the average person is a bundle of attributes of sex, creed, and locality. And this, I think, is what most of us prove to be. This is, we are conditioned by sex, by creed, by locality. And when we realize that, then in our lives, we can gradually make allowance for it and begin to overcome it. But of course, the other thing that goes with this constant effort to live and to exercise is dispassion. There are lots of words that might be used to express this. Non-attachment, desirelessness, uncoloredness, I think, is really perhaps one of the best words. To be able to see things without any personal bias. Of course, one can, and I think quite rightly, say that this is the equivalent of love, because love is also an outgoing, impersonal thing. Most people feel that this is a rather cold way of looking at love, but I think quite the reverse. Because if you are fond of someone, you are not thinking about yourself. You are thinking about their good only and nothing else. And this means that you are accepting them as they are. You don't want to change them. You take them for what they are and go out to them in this feeling of affection, wanting nothing in return. Now, this is the basis of the kind of life which is needed if we are to overcome this constant whirlpool that takes place in our conscious life and begin to discover what we are. It really means, in another sense, that we are seeking pure judgment, pure intelligence. That means impersonal judgment of things, not value-free. In fact, the judgments are value judgments. This is the difference between, as it were, the point of view of the occult science of yoga and the ordinary physical science of the world today, which so often claims it is value-free, because in that science there is no place for values at all. And as we can do this, the mind becomes a shining tool for the gaining of knowledge about the relative characteristics of things. For always it is the relation between ourselves and things and between things themselves that we are trying to understand so that we may live rightly in the world. And if we develop this impersonal point of view, the mind becomes a shining tool for the effective doing of that. this right knowledge that we gain by becoming impersonal gradually releases us from the spell of our thoughts and feelings, from the spell of our professional skills and our public images, and all these things that we create around ourselves, which are part of the ego process, and therefore which shuts us out from that universal life, which is the reality that lies behind everything. In other words, all this is a process towards the gaining of wisdom. The pure reason of the buddhi, to use the words of the Bhagavad Gita. And it is this that really indicates to us the limits of thought. It shows us that thought can only go so far and not beyond. You know, if you study the Madhyamika philosophy of Buddhism, you will find there that it analyzes quite carefully all the various ideas with regard to the nature of the world and the coming into being of existence and so on, and shows that all these ideas, all these theories, all these explanations about these ultimate processes always fall into absurdities, into a reducto ad absurdum, and therefore are in no sense ultimately true. Now, this should not lead us to a negative attitude, but should let us see that because of this, all our ideas about things are not sufficient, that reality always lies behind the mind. And so we try to discover that which lies at the root of our being. I think it is the seventh patriarch who in the Buddhist Bible says that right views are called heavenly, wrong views are called worldly. But when all views, both right and wrong, are given up, then the essence of wisdom may manifest itself. This is what we have to realize, that all our views about things are at best only partial views, and that reality lies entirely behind them. But we are trapped in the web of words with which we overlay our world. And really, to get out of that trap, we need discrimination. That discrimination which distinguishes the real from appearance. And it is the I-ness that we cling to. It is that which really discrimination points out to us. And this I-ness, this sense of ego, we are caught. And as I always like to put it, and I'm sure many of you have heard me give this simile before, like the monkey in a trap. You know, in countries where they have monkeys and want to trap them, one of the favorite ways is to take a jar which has a fairly narrow neck and put a prize that the monkey likes in the bottom of the jar. Now he puts his hand in the jar, he can get it in, but immediately he makes a fist around the object, the prize, he can't get his hand out. So he has to decide what he is going to do. Let go of the prize or be trapped. Well, of course, usually he doesn't let go of the prize and so he is trapped. Well, we are in much the same position as the monkey. We are trapped with this ego of ours. And we don't like to let it go. And until we do let it go, we are trapped. We are caught in a world in something from which we cannot free ourselves. Now, this is really what yoga is all about. Now, the path of yoga is a path of trying to constantly be aware of our conditioning and eliminate it, and to work with complete impersonality so that we free ourselves from the ego trap. There are, of course, many preliminary things that are laid down, the essence of practical yoga, where self-study to clarify the mind devotion to Ishvara in order to purify the emotions, and the building up of austerities by which we can, as it were, become aware of the will and of the intentionality of our lives. These are all processes which are done to remove the obstacles which these things present to all our lives. These are the cause of sorrow, the human condition of which all these preliminary exercises are devoted. And of course, in one sense, ignorance is always the cause of these obstacles. And this is not the ignorance which can be overcome by knowledge attained by the mind. The erudite man is just as much caught in this trap as the non-erudite. In fact, I often think far more caught in this trap. And so it is this which constantly confronts us in all our lives. The obstacles that we have to overcome, these obstacles of ignorance, are really the cause of karma, the way in which we bind ourselves. And the nature of our life depends on karma, that is, the way we deal with the obstacles. The obstacles are things that we have created by our past. The way we deal with them now somehow modifies the whole nature of our future life. And when, of course, we are free of these obstacles, then we are free from the whole karmic process. Now, to do this, all the literature and all the yogic books indicate that one of the essential things is meditation. And most of us who are at all concerned with knowing ourselves are somehow concerned with meditation. And really, meditation is a remaking of our consciousness. It's an endeavor to get a direct experience of our biological and psychic and conceptual lives. And it is really intended, meditation as I see it, to purify both our psyches and conceptual nature so that they do not cloud our vision. You know, I've been reading the last few days something of the history of the Point Loma group and the work that went on at Point Loma. And you will see how people are so often misled by the claimed vision of another person. And the purpose of meditation is to let us see beyond these claims, to see whether these are truly visions or merely the working of another mind. And meditation should always lead us to that. But one of the great things about meditation, which I think we frequently forget, is that meditation must result in action. It must result in a better life. It's a process of looking in, but it's also a process of looking out from the position that one achieves in meditation. In other words, in many ways, meditation is always the practice of an attitude, not an attitude that we retain in those moments of meditation, but that an attitude that we hold all the time in our lives, so that we can see the world and see what we do from the point of view of that meditative experience. The purpose of meditation is to break down our mental and emotional conceptual patterns, all the ruts that we have created in our psychic and mental lives, and to be rid of them, not to create new patterns. For meditation is always a creative process, and a creative process is not done according to a pattern. A creative process is done creatively. that it is the new coming into experience, not merely the repetition of the past. And all patterns are a repetition of the past. So we meditate. Why? Certainly not to realize a higher ego, not a bigger version of ourselves, not to find instant enlightenment, which is a myth anyway. It is none of these things, but it is in order that we may become more human, that is, more universal, more concerned with the whole of mankind, more brotherly, if you wish. This is the whole purpose of meditation. It should lead to a state of heart and mind which is poised, which is centered on the real, which is non-egotistical, which is infinitely sensitive to others and to nature. For we are no longer in the meditative experience concerned with a personal consciousness, that is, with something which is nourished by its own history, but by a witnessing consciousness, as it were, something which is lucid, something which is spontaneous, something which partakes of this nature of the real. Now, there are many different kinds of meditation, and the books are full of them. And they are interesting to see the ways in which various people have exercised themselves in this process to discover for themselves something of their own reality. But remember, as I said, I think it is all very well to try these things, and I think we all should. But we must remember that so long as we are following a pattern laid down by someone else, we are not truly discovering ourselves. We are merely following a pattern. We are not creative. And the one thing I think which we share with that reality of which we are a part is that we are creative beings. Just as it creates the cosmos, so in our way create our own world. You remember once again that Madame Blavatsky says that man should be ever striving to be a co-worker with nature in the cyclic task. The cyclic task of creativity is something that we share with nature and which we should be engaged in. So I say that and mention these particular types of meditation, not to lay down a pattern which should be followed, but to show the ways in which others have reached some understanding until they have discovered their own way and their own method. There is, first of all, of course, the devotional type of meditation, which is perhaps one of the most popular, particularly amongst religious people. The devotion to Ishvara, to God, that sense of trying to always live as if one were in the light of that divine presence, to constantly feel that all our energies, all our thoughts, and all our lives are dedicated to that. This is something, of course, which you will find amongst many religious people and has through the ages been perhaps one of the most, shall I say, popular or universal types of meditative experience throughout the churches. And then there is the type of meditation of which I think all students of theosophy are well aware, samyana, in which we start off with the waking consciousness. We then try, as it were, to withdraw from the senses so that we can sit quietly without being in any way affected by the sensory impressions that are impressed upon us from the external world, so that we don't react, as it were, to the sensory thing, but can withdraw within ourselves. Then we concentrate upon some particular subject, what is known as dharana, This is what the voice of the silence starts off to talk about and is really involved in much of its earlier part, to learn the nature of concentration of dharana. And then, having learned to concentrate, to go, as it were, a step beyond that, to dhyana, to wisdom, where the flow of thought, as it were, follows the line of concentration. We begin to see things in a more universal fashion. I think in many ways, dhyana, this state, is what the secret doctrine is all about. That if you read the stanzas of Zan, you see, as it were, expressed the whole of this particular point in meditation. In fact, that is what the stanzas of Zan are. And this leads us, in this sequence, to contemplation, to samadhi, to use the Eastern phrase, where we are no longer aware of ourselves nor what we're thinking about, but are, as it were, in a completely at one stage. I think the important thing to realize about this, that when we reach samadhi, you can't say, now I am in samadhi, because if you do, you're not there. It is something which involves the totality of ourselves. It's not something that you can stand apart from and look at. It is a total experience. And it is not the end. Some people feel that attaining samadhi is to attain it for all time. Not at all. You feel, you know, you experience, use whatever word you will. And in that stage, you somehow receive a sense of illumination, of vision, which inspires you to go out into the world and try to act and work from that point of view. This is the end. Samadhi is not a goal, except a goal for meditation. But that is only part of the process. You then have to breathe out and act in the world from that point of view. The great symbol of life has always been the symbol of breath. Of course, in many forms of yoga, breathing exercises and so on, are part and parcel of the exercises that one goes through. You breathe in, you assimilate, but then you breathe out. And you cannot live without it. I constantly recommend people to do this and prove that this is true. We all know it, but we forget. Keep on breathing in and try not to breathe out. You won't do it for very long. And you soon find that you have to breathe out, that the whole three processes are necessary for our life. Inhaling, assimilating, exhaling. And the same thing is true in our meditative experience. Somehow, we gather in all that life has taught us. We assimilate this. We look at it. We become one with it. We no longer have to think about it because it has become part of ourselves. And then, from that attitude, we go out and operate in the world till another stage comes along and a new experience. And then there is a type of meditation which I think is comparatively little spoken about in the books, but is just as valuable in its own way as any of these. And this is what I like to think of as the aesthetic form of meditation, the skill in action, the sculptor, the painter, the man who does anything skillfully and well, who is wholly absorbed in what he is doing, so that what he is doing takes control. As it were, I think it was Du Baffet who said that in the creative act of painting, there is no ego self. There is merely the painting that takes over. And other artists have said the same thing, that the act, the artistic act, is something where the aesthetic experience takes over, and one strives for this wholeness, this completeness, this expression of the vision that one has. This too is meditation. This too is a way of completely at-oneing ourselves. This too is a way of letting go of ego and doing things to the very best of our ability. And then, finally, the one that I want to mention is, of course, one that you will find frequently in Buddhism, where the whole idea of meditation is mindfulness. Not a retiring to a quiet place, but in all our lives and in all our experience, being mindful of what is happening. Being mindful of the person that you are dealing with, of the thing that you are doing, so that you can act in the very best relationship at that particular moment. So that one's life is, as it were, a constant meditative process, where one is constantly aware, constantly mindful of all our relationships in the world. I feel, of course, that our lives are always concerned with relationships. We're related to the external world, and all the things that we do in that external world, all the manipulating of the materials of the world, is one of the great relationships that involves the work of so many of us. And then we are related to other people. Surely the commitment to brotherhood, and this, of course, what I think is the essence of theosophy, the commitment to brotherhood means the commitment to a right relationship with every individual with whom one comes in contact. And this is a very large order. It is not at all easy. I know when I was comparatively young apprentice, I was very impatient with some of the people that I worked with. And my boss came to me one day in England and he said, "Ross," he said, "you have to learn to suffer fools gladly." I think it was very good advice. Throughout the years, I've come that I think I can, with a considerable amount of success, suffer fools. But I still find the gladly very hard. And yet, this is what is involved in right relationship. That we relate to all people, whatever their nature, and in that way produce that harmony which is the essence of brotherhood. And then, of course, we are related to ourselves. Although, in many ways, I think this is now a wrong phrase, that the words are not adequate. In other words, we are not really related to our true nature. We are our true nature. That is the real man. And this means dropping, letting go of the ego, so that it can shine forth in what we do. This is the way of yoga. This, I think, is the way of all aspirants who are trying to discover what is real and to live in the world, not blinded by the Maya, not deluded by the illusions that are around them, but centered on the real, so, as I said, they can be poised, they can have a clear vision and see what must be done. And then, if they are skillful, We can never get away from learning our skills. We can perhaps do something to bring about that vision into actual fact. Thank you. Does anybody any questions?
Did you say with regard to Maya that where we have a feeling that there is a real and then there is something else that is not real, and that then is, then one is in the myopic condition?
This is it. In other words, the Maya and reality are not two worlds. There's just one world. As the Buddhists say, Nirvana and Samsara, the ultimate and the world of coming and going, are one world. It is the way we look at it. And as long as we think of the Maya as being real, then we are deluded. In other words, it is then an illusion. But when we see it for what it is, then we can use it in order to forward the ends of life.
Well, in all these different forms of yoga, is there any process or something that one could use to decide or try to find out which one would be appropriate at various stages of one's life?
I think the only process that one can use is to try them and see which one sort of produces a feeling of well-being, of satisfaction, that one is becoming more impersonal, more brotherly, and so on. I don't see that there is any other way in which it can be done. I think, you know, Popper, Karl Popper, the great philosopher, has said that all our life is really, we face a problem and we come up with a tentative theory. Then what we have to do is to test that theory. And we have to remember that no repetition of the same proof adds anything to it. For example, if you say all swans are black and you see 1,000 black swans, this doesn't really mean very much, because you only have to see one white swan to show that you are wrong. In other words, tentative theories can never really be proved right, but they can always be proved wrong. But in that test, in the testing process, and this I think is what we should do with the various yogas, in the testing process, we ultimately come up with a new theory, another way, an improved way of looking at it, and then we start the whole process over again. And I think this is what we have to do with these various yogas. We have a problem and we think that such a form of yoga, such an exercise, will benefit us, will make life more understandable, will be worthwhile. So we try it, we experiment with it, and we say, this isn't it, this doesn't satisfy the problem, and so we try another one. And ultimately, out of this, we begin to form our own yoga. We begin to see, well, following none of these patterns is really helping me to discover myself. But I am trying to live in such a way, and in that living, I begin to discover it a little more. I think, of course, if one is temperamentally a very devoted person, then you tend to go in for the more devotional types of yoga. If, on the other hand, you are a person who is essentially activist, then you tend to go in for those yogas which are concerned with action for the good of mankind, which is, of course, what I think the Gita is largely about. If you're an intellectual, then you start off with the more intellectual types of meditation. And of course, I think the intellectual is always handicapped. I think this is always one of the most difficult processes, because the intellectual tends to be egotistical. The mind is that which emphasizes ego, and the intellectual, who tends always to feel that he is right and that he can explain anything and so on, tends therefore to be far more egotistical than the others. So I sometimes think he has the hardest road to hoe. But still, the mind is an essential part of life, and we have to follow it up. But in all these, we have to try, and we have to be aware that we are not looking for results which satisfy our ego. In other words, we're not trying to pat ourselves on the back. In fact, if we can find a process which gives us a good kick in the pants, I think it's far more likely to do us good, because we learn by our mistakes rather than by our successes. Our successes, unfortunately, tend to be egotistical, make us egotistical. Our failures, if we can look at them rightly, perhaps will help us to get away from being attached to the results. And this is part of the ego. And in this way, we discover in our own particular way the kind of yoga, the kind of life that is best for us.
Thanks, General. Thank you all for coming.